Morning, everybody. Welcome to the fifth of our workshops on early Buddhism. This week we're dealing with wisdom. And we have to give our apologies. Ajahn Brahmali is not able to be here today. And please don't think that's because he doesn't have any wisdom. That's not the case. He has plenty, but he has is otherwise engaged in Indonesia. So, yeah, he went to Indonesia yesterday morning. So somehow Indonesia seems to be the place to go to these days. Ajahn Brahms has come back from Indonesia. Ajahn Brahmali's there. And I'm going to Indonesia tomorrow morning. So it's the place to be, apparently. Anyway, for this morning, we're going to look at wisdom. And we're going to try to understand something about what wisdom is, how it fits into the Buddhist path, and how we should develop it. What's the purpose of it? And as with the previous workshops, I will be interspersing in the slides some random images, and these are all images that come up from the sophisticated research technology of Googling early Buddhist wisdom. So these are what we find. Now, and also as with the previous workshops, we'll be talking for a while and then doing some sitting, so hopefully we'll be able to break the time up so we don't have too much information all at once. And if you have any questions and comments and so on, then you're most welcome to ask those. But remember that the questions during the main group should be brief and to the point to try to clarify something that we're talking about. And if you want to go into something in more detail, we'll be having the discussion session this afternoon, and that's what that's for, if you want to really talk around a particular topic. Okay. So for the first image here, I chose the image of a tree. This is one of the random images that Google threw up. And I think it's a very lovely image for wisdom, and it captured some of the things which for me were important in trying to present about what wisdom is and how it works within a Buddhist context. So one of the things which is interesting about it is the relationship between the manifold and the one, right? The many and the one, right? You have many leaves in the tree and one trunk, yeah? And so they all come back to that same place. And so what we tend to see when we see a tree is we see all the individual things, all the individual leaves, which are all different. But even though each of the leaves is different, they all have a similar kind of pattern. They have a similar shape, right? They have a similar function. And if we trace each of those leaves back, we all come to the same trunk. And so to me, this is very indicative of how wisdom is developed in Buddhism, that we start by looking at the leaves. We start by looking at all of the individual things that happen to us, the specific feelings that we have, the specific thoughts that we have, the specific sense impressions that we have, the specific ideas that we have. And we look at each one of those and examine that carefully. And as we examine each one of those carefully, and as we do that over more and more, we gradually realize that there's a pattern to it, that each thought has some kind of, there's something similar in the way that thought works to other thoughts. Each feeling that we have has something similar in it, something related to other feelings that we have. And from there, we're able to trace things back and to look, well, what's the source? Where do these things come from? We realize that similarity, and of course this is where we come from the trunk down into the roots. Yeah? And if we really want to understand the tree and how the tree works, then we have to trace things back to the roots and to the cause. So for Buddhism, wisdom is always about tracing things back to the cause, understanding where do things come from. Okay, so when we're looking at wisdom, I think everybody has everyone has some idea of what wisdom is, right? But we find it's not necessarily the easiest thing to articulate. And I tried to test out this morning by asking some people what's wisdom, And I got some very profound responses, like, what is wisdom? great wisdom. So it's this kind of thing that we intuitively have some impression of what it means, but it's difficult to define it or articulate it. I guess like all the good things in life. Anyway, one way that we can, I think, get a handle on it is by looking at somehow an idea of the depth of knowing or the structure of knowledge. And I think you can see in that list there that you're moving from something which is a relatively shallow form of knowledge towards something which is a much deeper form of knowing. So when you think of data, it's very specific. Remember the idea of the tree, the specific things. So data is like, you know, ones and zeros and so on and so forth. It's completely undigested. You can get masses of it, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything, right? So you can then process data and make information out of it. You can turn data into graphs and tables and so on and so forth to present the data, which makes it more informative. You can actually extract some kind of meaning from it. But even that information itself is quite shallow. So then knowledge, again, is somewhat deeper. Understanding, yeah, deeper still. Understanding, maybe we think of understanding as being something like seeing things in their context. Yeah, yeah, broader way of looking at it. It's not so caught on specifics, but it's more synthetic. You understand everything together, how things work together. And wisdom is the word for the deepest of all kinds of knowledge. So in that process, I think one of the characteristics of this process of the different levels of knowing is a move from things which are more specific to things which are more general. And one of the saying I always remember from Niels Bohr, the great quantum theorist, who said that the opposite of a shallow truth is a falsehood, but the opposite of a profound truth is another profound truth. Yeah? So I think that's profoundly true, so that means that the opposite of it is also true. Yeah? So when we have information, right, information will help you to cope with a specific circumstance or a specific set of circumstances. Right? But wisdom will help you cope with life. Right? Whatever life throws up at you, you can see it. You can understand it. So there's a move from something more specific and more limited towards something which is more general. And we see this process happening right the way through the early Buddhist texts. And one of the things that we find from that is that there's something about the human mind, which, and probably not just the human mind, I don't want to be speciesist or alienist or anything like that. Aliens and so on, I'm sure, have the same thing. But something about the mind that wants to know. Right? We want to know. It feels good to know things. Yeah? Someone asks you a question and you know the answer. Oh, I know the answer. Yeah? I noticed this last week. I got a pair of glasses the first time, and I'm like, wow, I didn't realize the universe was so sharp. I had no idea. I've been walking around in this haze for all these years. And he realized just, you know, I just had so much fun just putting the glasses on and seeing things and then taking them off and seeing them be fuzzy again. You realize how there's nothing else to it, right? It doesn't actually give you anything else, but just inherently the clarity is better, right? You like to know things clearly, yeah? And this is a quality of the mind which wants to know. And I think that this is something which is actually very, very important, and I think very, very positive, very optimistic. If we look at humanity and ourselves and who we are and where our life is going. Because often we can look at the world and we can become very pessimistic. We think that everybody is just after something, everybody just wants gains and so on. But actually, there is something in the mind that wants to know. And I think it's from that desire to know, that all the good things in life come. There was an interesting progression in Western psychology, and very famously Freud said that our basic desire was to feel pleasure, yeah, the pleasure principle. Adler was one of his students who said our basic desire is to have power. And then Jung came along and said, no, our basic desire is to know, is to be conscious. Yeah? And there's, I think, something very powerful and very beautiful about that insight. Now, which one of those desires is more or less basic or whatever, I'm not going to say, but I think it is true to say that within the mind, there is, at a very fundamental level, the desire to become more conscious. And it's that desire which, when we hook into that and when we go along with that, that is the desire which leads ultimately to awakening. Of course, Buddhism, as far as I know, the only religion in the world that's actually named after wisdom. Right? The word Buddha means awakened. Yeah? It's a word for wisdom. So this idea of wisdom is so fundamental to what we're doing. So, of course, there are wisdom traditions within all of the world spiritual traditions and so on. But within Buddhism, what we find is that there's not just that respect for wisdom, there's not just a content of wisdom that's passed down, but there's also a very clear and pragmatic way of training which is described of how to become wise, yeah, how to develop wisdom. And so the Buddhist path is working together to help us to develop wisdom. So if we think of a definition of wisdom, here's just one that I thought of, and obviously not trying to encapsulate it 100%. Actually, this one should be corrected. Somebody at the last workshop I gave made a suggestion, which is probably best. I forgot to make the change on the slide, but the definition here, an act of understanding that generalizes from immediate experience to encompass the whole of what is possible. And the suggestion that was given at the last workshop was that it should be the whole of what is knowable rather than what is possible, which I think is right. I think that should probably, I know there's some people copying them down there, so you put the whole of what is knowable. Okay, so there's a few points that I wanted to make in this definition. First thing about it is that wisdom is an act. Okay, so wisdom, like everything that we're talking about in this Buddhist path, like the ethics, like meditation, wisdom is not a thing, it's a behavior. Yeah, it's what you do. I think this is the first and most crucial point to understand. Actually, in the Pali language, we very frequently find that when a noun is defined, that it's defined in terms of a verb. So, for example, if it says, what is understanding? It says that one understands. That's what understanding is. Yeah. So, in other words, that it's not a thing, it's an act. Okay. And this makes a profound difference in how we approach the very concept of wisdom. Normally, when we, reflectingly or in a sort of common sense or natural language way, we talk about wisdom, we think of it as a faculty which people possess to greater or lesser degrees. right? And we even try to kind of quantify that through IQ, for example. Yeah? And we think that a person has a certain IQ, because it's completely ridiculous. There's no such thing as an IQ that a person has, right? You don't measure a person's IQ. What you measure is the answers that a person gives to the questions that are asked when they do the IQ test. Right? That's what you're measuring. Yeah. Now, of course, that has some relation to, you know, the intelligence and so on that a person exhibits at other occasions, but it's not as if it's a fixed quantity. And wisdom is even more so. So wisdom is not something that some people have and other people don't have. And I think this is something that we can all observe very easily in experience. It's very common to see that there are people who, in some fields, will be in some situations, will be very wise. Yeah? And other fields and situations are completely stupid. Yeah? It happens all the time. Yeah? So wisdom is not like a fixed thing that we have. However, one of the aspects of wisdom, and if we come back to that idea of the depth of knowing, I think one of the things we can say about wisdom is that one of the differences, I guess, between, say, understanding and wisdom, and here I'm just using terminology to get across some ideas, so I don't get hung up on the terms too much, but I guess that understanding might apply within a specific context, whereas wisdom applies to every context, applies to within life. Yeah? So someone with true wisdom, in the sense I'm talking about here, would act in a wise way in any context. Even contexts that they don't know anything about. So that's the first thing. Wisdom is an act of understanding. It's what you do. And when we look at wisdom in that way, then that's very empowering, right? Because no matter how stupid you are, you can always do something wise, right? And it's also a warning, no matter how smart you think you are, right? You can always do things that are stupid. Yeah? It's what you do. And because what we do is nothing fixed. We change what we do at every moment. Right? You're just sitting there in chairs passively listening to what I'm saying there now, but you're changing what you do, how you respond, how you pay attention, how you feel, how you think. These things are changing all the time. And by paying attention to this, reflecting on it, and deepening the way that we know, we can gradually develop that wisdom so that it's not just something occasional, but it's something that becomes a habit, it becomes ingrained in us. Yeah. Uh-huh. What do you mean by sits and does nothing? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not meaning act in a physical sense. No. Well, it's a I'm not talking about physical acts, I'm talking about psychological act. Yeah. Yes, you think or you understand. That would be one aspect of it, yeah. Yeah. Right. Sure. Yeah. No, you're quite right there. That was actually something I was planning to bring up a bit later on. But yeah, you're quite right. It's and I think this is one of the areas where contemporary psychology has really shifted from a kind of a dichotomy between the intellect and the emotions to now understanding that these things actually are completely intertwined. And certainly this is what we find from the early Buddhist texts right from the beginning, that wisdom is always associated with these emotional qualities, loving kindness and compassion and so on. So absolutely, yeah. Yeah, well, we were talking more about that later on. Yep. No. Well, because things aren't anyway. Can we talk about that a little bit later on? Yeah, again, that's another thing I had down for later on. Yeah. Okay, so an act of understanding that generalizes from immediate experience. Okay, so we start with immediate experience, not what we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste. And one of the great purposes of meditation, of course, is to bring us closer to that immediate experience. Right? So we normally operate at quite an abstract level. Right? Our understanding happens at quite an abstract level of you know people and places and ideas and so on and so forth. So what we try to do in meditation is we come down, what is a sight like? What is a sound like? What is a thought like? What is a feeling like? And we try to get in touch with that immediacy of experience as we live. Okay? And the closer that we come to that and the more that we can experience the phenomena that are happening with as little mediation and as little filtering as possible, then the better, if you like, the better data we have, the better information we have that can inform our wisdom. Okay, so this is generalizing from immediate experience, or if you like, inferring from immediate experience. So wisdom always has an aspect of inference. This is also very important and something which I think is quite badly misrepresented in some forms of modern Buddhism. That's all they'll say, you have to be direct experience and that's it, and there's no role for inference. This is not true. The suttas always talk about the role of inference in understanding, and this is a part of the Buddhist discussion and understanding. Of course, the relationship between experience and inference is a complex one, but we have to infer from experience. We have to be able to generalize it. Yeah. I can see that this glass of water is impermanent, huh? But how do I know that the next glass of water might be permanent? Maybe the next glass I can just keep on drinking from and it'll never get empty. Yeah? How do I know that? Well, I know that from inference. Yeah? Actually, I don't even know that this glass of water is going to be empty except by inference. Because actually I can't see that glass being empty, I can just see it. It's not quite half full, it's about a third full. Anyway, I'll talk more about this later, but this idea that you start with immediate experience, you infer from that, and you to encompass the whole of what is possible, or the whole of what is knowable. You think about what scientists do. You know, you sit there in a laboratory or in a telescope or something like that, and you make some kind of inference, and you can observe things, and you can go all the way down to subatomic particles and so on. I don't know if you saw a few weeks ago, they came up with the first photographs of atoms. It was from like a hydrogen atom or something like that, and there's actually a photograph of it. So you can go down to such a tiny, tiny level, and then you can go all the way up to galaxies and the universe and the Big Bang and so on. Of course, you can't observe those things directly, right? You can only understand them by inference. And yet we know from science that if that practice of inference is done in a way that's very careful, if the information that you start with is of very good quality and the level of inference, the level of rigor you put into the inference is very careful, you can actually make very powerful generalizations that will be true across a very, very broad spectrum. And we apply the same idea in Buddhism, right? So just as in science, you know, Newton sees an apple falling down and he infers from that, he generalizes and says, ah, every apple falls down. Oh, maybe oranges fall down too. And pears and grapefruit, and then infers from that a law of gravity. Right? See, it's not obvious. In fact, it's completely counterintuitive to say that the falling down of the apple is falling down for the under following the same forces, and we can describe it in the same way as why the stars stay in the sky. That's the trick of gravity, right? It's not seeing an apple falling down. We can all see an apple falling down. But you see, why do the stars stay up? That's the trick. And how do we explain them using the same principle, right? That the stars stay up and the apple falls down. And that's the power of inference and the power of generalization. So this happens within science. Same way that the Buddha used in Buddhism. We understand, for example, impermanence. You look at things, you watch them emerge into awareness, you watch them stay for a while, you watch them disappear, and you keep looking at that process. And as you look at that process, you see everything that you can possibly see also follows that same pattern. And no matter what the scale, whether it's a huge scale of cosmoses and eons, or it's a tiny little scale of just the tiniest flicker of awareness, we can see the same pattern happening at every level. Right? So this is encompassing the whole of what is knowable. Okay, so this is just a working definition of wisdom, so it would hopefully capture a few of the aspects of it, which I think are important that we'll look more at later on. Okay, so we've been going for a little while already. Let's do some meditation for the next 10 minutes. Okay, so moving on. So, as with everything in the Dhamma, wisdom has an essentially pragmatic purpose. So wisdom is not something which is an end in itself. And even though it's such an important intrinsic part of the Buddhist path, the point of the path is not to become a wise person. The point of the path is to become free. Yeah? The goal of the Buddhist path is liberation, not wisdom. So that suggests that the accumulation or developing of wisdom for its own sake is not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is a development of wisdom in the manner that's going to be useful, that's leading to liberation. And we've seen in the earlier workshops about how intrinsically linked and connected these ideas are, the ethics leading to meditation and samadhi, the samadhi leading to a depth of wisdom. And the wisdom itself functions to lead to freedom. So the connections between these things are very deep and very subtle, and there are many different kinds of ways that they're connected. But the most basic way that meditation ethics are connected to wisdom is that our wisdom is deepened because of the clarity of our awareness. Yeah? So remember the simile of the still forest pool. So one of the basic similes for wisdom that's given in the early Buddhist text. Yeah? When the pool is clear and still, then you can see all the fish swimming around and the weeds growing and the rocks in the pool. So through the practice of ethics, through the practice of meditation, we're learning to still the mind. The mind becomes clear. And when that mind is clear, wisdom can begin. Okay? So it's very, very important to understand with all of these things that the reality, the lived reality of them, is that these things all come together. Right? They're not actually separate things. Our behavior, our ethics and meditation and the development of wisdom and all of these things, they're all part of the same thing. They're all just how we live. And to try to understand them better, we tease them out into separate categories and we analyze them from different angles. But in fact, ultimately it's just your mind, isn't it? Right? All of these things are happening in your mind. So don't mistake even though we're separating them, don't think that you know, they're somehow in reality they're separated. In reality they're all together. But we just separate them for understanding better. Anyway, this was one of the images that got thrown up when I searched for early Buddhist wisdom. The Aqua Buddha Club. Something like that, yeah. Yeah, it's awesome. Burgess Meredith, distinguished actor and member of the Aqua Buddha Club. Anyway, that's kind of random. Has nothing to do with wisdom. Okay, moving on. Yeah. No, well, if you look at the suttas, and you see how the Buddha answered questions. Yeah. Was that just an absence? Can you just answer things if you just kind of like a bucket is absent, an empty bucket? Can that give answers to the questions? An empty bucket can give answers to the questions. Sometimes, yeah, but other times you didn't. Yeah. So wisdom is something that you do. Yeah, wisdom's an act. Yeah. All right. Three kinds of wisdom. Now, I'm going to apologize at this point in the proceedings because we're supposed to be talking about early Buddhism, and I'm going to deviate a little bit to talk about the commentaries and some later developments. And I'm doing this because these have been things that have been helpful for me to understand the suttas, but also because there's some ideas that I wanted to address in how we will often find Buddhism talked about in contemporary culture. So it's important to notice these things as well. Now, this is a distinction which I've personally found extremely useful. And this is something that we find in the commentaries, but as with many things that we find in the commentaries, it's a kind of a simplification or systematization of things which are implied many times in the suttas. So the commentaries describe three stages in the development of wisdom. First one, jnata parinya, second one, tirana parinya, understanding by scrutiny, and the last one, understanding by letting go, pahana parinya. And this mirrors that hierarchy of knowing that I talked about earlier. Yeah? So the jnata parinya, understanding the known, effectively means understanding the phenomena that we experience. Okay, so this is like the data or information gathering stage of things. Yeah? So when we're developing that particular knowledge, say in meditation, we'll do that through a simple way of doing that is through investigating the six senses. Yeah? So sight, eye, and the sight and eye consciousness. Yeah? And you can look at that. What is sight like? What is it like to see? What is the eye consciousness like? And you can tease those things out and look at them. Ah, what's seeing like? How is seeing different from hearing? Right? And you can sit there in meditation. You can look at what's the quality of sound and how is that different from the quality of sight? And you realize that they're completely different kinds of things. So this is one way we can develop this first kind of understanding is the jnata parinya, understanding the known, is what is presented to consciousness. The second one is understanding by scrutiny, or tirana parinya, and what this is talking about is more the inferential knowledge and the knowledge of relationships. Okay? So how are these things connected? So, for example, tirana parinya would be understanding, traditionally it's described as understanding anicca dukkha anatta, yeah? Impermanent suffering and not self. And also understanding dependent origination. So in that particular context, you might see, well, you have your eye, you have a sight, you have a sound. And let's say you meet somebody and you're talking to them, well, the eye sees things, the sound hears things, right? But then there's an act of understanding or synthesis in the mind which puts those together and says, this is that person, right? And so you're seeing, actually this is a relationship. There's actually two separate things, the sight and the hearing. And then there's the mind, which is a mental act that puts those things together. And that this is, of course, conditioned, right? And is impermanent. Right. And so it's understanding those kinds of things, the connections, how the world's built up at a deeper level, and ultimately seeing impermanent suffering and not self, that is meant by tirana parinya, is understanding by scrutiny. And in the traditional explanation, this is the deeper levels of vipassana meditation. And understanding by letting go is what they call pahana parinya. Yeah? So this is where you let go of suffering, let go of your attachments. Yeah? As I mentioned before, the purpose of wisdom is not to become wise. The purpose of wisdom is to let go. Okay, so the wisdom has done its purpose when you can let go. If you haven't let go, you don't have enough wisdom yet. Right? So I find that's quite a useful way of categorizing or understanding that process. Yeah. Yep. Oh, absolutely. That's right. That's one of the aspects of it for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. So it's more like a reflective understanding of things. Yes. What specifically? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's... don't make it... Yeah, don't worry, I just made that up. And the point is that if you have the real understanding, the full depth of understanding is that understanding when you let go. Yeah? Exactly, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yep. That's a more, kind of more detailed. And that's why, as I said, it's, you know, these ideas are the same as the ideas we find in the suttas, but it's just a convenient way of presenting it, yeah. Yeah. So the important point here is that the wisdom leads to letting go. Okay. Now, I want to talk about this dichotomy between ultimate and conventional reality, which is something which you find very commonly in modern Buddhist traditions and is actually an important part of the teaching of most Buddhist traditions, and it's not something that you find in the early Buddhist texts. And I wanted to make this discuss this point explicitly, because if you read around in Buddhism and different books from whatever tradition, whether it's Theravadan or Tibetan tradition, Zen tradition, then you'll often find this distinction being made. And I think that it's not only one that's... You know, sometimes we find things in the commentaries in the later traditions which are useful, as with the previous case. It's something I found in the tradition to be very useful understanding. This particular one I find is not only unuseful, I think it's positively pernicious, and it's actually a dishonest teaching because it pretends to be something that it actually isn't. So to how it's usually understood is something like this, and the specific explanations of it will differ according to different traditions, but the general idea is something like this. When we live in our ordinary world, we go about our lives, we meet people, we have meetings and ideas, and we meet trees and so on and so forth. Sometimes we talk to the trees and sometimes they talk back or whatever. And this is like a conventional reality that we live in. And that reality is ultimately delusional, and the real reality is what we call the ultimate reality, and that consists not of people and things, but of say consciousness, feeling, perception, contact, and so on and so forth, which are the ultimate realities according to the later traditions and their understanding of things. So this is a bit analogous to the situation, say, in science, where you might say, well, we think that we have, you know, plastic and wood and glass and things like that, but actually they're all just made up of chemicals combined in different kinds of ways, and so the chemicals are the ultimate reality. Of course, the problem with that is, well, then you ask a physicist what the ultimate reality is, and the physicist will say the ultimate reality isn't chemicals. It's atoms and electrons and protons, except it's probably not those. It's probably quarks or maybe strings or something like that, except we're not really sure what the ultimate reality is or even if there is one, right? So the problem with this is that this distinction has a number of problems. First thing we notice is that it is not found at all in the suttas. Okay. Now the purpose of this distinction, where it's usually brought in, is in understanding the difference between why did the Buddha talk about I and me and talk about meeting people and so on and so forth, when he also taught not self, right? So how can we reconcile not the idea of not self with the idea of the Buddha's talking about self and so on? Now, in fact, that's a problem which is no more interesting or difficult than the problem of asking, you know, how can a chemist say, I saw a tree or something, when he knows he's seeing a complex interaction of organic compounds? How is it that a physicist can say, I drank a glass of water, when he really knows that all he's drinking is quarks and protons and electrons, right? Well, of course they do, because they're not stupid. That would be one explanation. We encounter these kinds of things all the time, and there are more and less specific and technical ways of dealing with and describing phenomena in different circumstances and at different times. And we always do these things all the time. And there's no need to infer or understand from that any one of these levels and ways of looking at things is more ultimate than the others. They might be more precise, they might be more accurate, they might be more specific, they might be more technical, they might have a certain function and be useful in certain circumstances, but that doesn't mean that they're a kind of ultimate description of reality. And when we look at these ultimate descriptions of reality, we find that often they include very odd things which aren't really ultimate at all. For example, taste, just to give an obvious example, is supposed to be one of the ultimate realities according to the Abhidhamma tradition, whereas obviously we know that taste is not fundamental or ultimate at all. It's quite a high-order phenomena that arises because of an interaction of complex organic compounds and so on, and taste receptors and biology and neurons and all of these things. It's actually quite a high-level phenomena. This idea that things can be traced down to some kind of ultimate reality is, I think, illusory. It's unnecessary. It doesn't actually solve any problems. But what it does do, actually, and this is why I think that it's pernicious, is because it pretends to solve a philosophical problem, right? But its actual purpose is not to solve a philosophical problem at all. Its actual purpose is to exalt one's own view and disparage the views of others. My view is the ultimate view, your view is the conventional view. That's how it's actually used. And if you look at how it's talked about in Buddhist dialogue, most of the time, that's how it's talked about. The Theravadins will say the Abhidhamma is the ultimate reality and the suttas are conventional reality, right? So therefore the Abhidhamma is better than the suttas, right? So in other words, you don't have to really look at what the Buddha taught, you can look at what I'm teaching and that's better, right? Or if you look in the Tibetan tradition or the Zen tradition and so on, then they'll have similar arguments which will say that the other schools and other philosophies and approaches to Buddhism, they're fine in a conventional sense, but our teaching is the ultimate sense. So I see this as being primarily a rhetorical device in order to exalt one's own view. In the suttas, everything is conventional. All truth is conventional, because whenever we're talking about truth and describing it, we're using language, and language is made up of conventions, and we should not mistake those conventions for the realities that they're describing. No? The only thing, this word that they're using for ultimate is paramatta. Okay? So paramatta is not a suburb in Sydney. Okay? Paramatta is... paramatta is a... means ultimate, yeah? It means the highest goal. The literal meaning of it is the highest goal, and it's only used in the suttas to refer to Nibbana. Okay? So Nibbana is the paramatta satcha, is the ultimate reality or the ultimate truth. Okay? Now, Once, if we accept that, then that's fine. But then we're left with a bit of a problem, which is that clearly there's a difference between talking about, say, I met a person and so on, and talking about things like there was an experience of consciousness. I mean, there's a difference between talking at that level of ordinary discourse and a more precise way of talking that we use in technical meditative context. And that's that kind of distinction which that ultimate and conventional reality distinction was trying to get at. And the distinction remains meaningful, even if we don't want to phrase it in those terms of ultimate conventional reality. And so that particular problem was addressed by the great Buddhist philosopher Vasubandhu in about the 4th century. And rather than that dualism, he came up with a threefold distinction. And I generally, in philosophy, I like threes. I think threes are much nicer than twos. Twos tend to be a bit, black and white. And when there's three, there's always kind of a bit of nuance to it. There's always a kind of bit more wiggle room with a three than there is with a two. So anyway, here we have the three. I don't want to go into this in too much detail, but you can follow this up. The book is probably in the library there, Seven Treatises of Vasubandhu. And he talks about the three kinds of truth. One is what they call parikalpita, which is the imaginary, which is more or less what we call conventional reality. It's more or less equivalent to that level of conventional reality as described in the Theravada and Abhidhamma. So, thinking in terms of rocks and people and places and things and ideas and concepts and so on. This is the imaginary. Imaginary is not meant there in a derogatory term. It just means a sense of conceptualized reality. And then the paratantrika is the interdependent. And so this is more or less equivalent to what happens in vipassana meditation, again from the Theravadin point of view. So this is like directly seeing of sights and sounds and smells and the five khandhas and these things, seeing them as impermanent and suffering, seeing them as interdependent and so on. And so that level is called the paratantrika, the interdependent. And then finally you have the parinishpana, which is the perfected or the consummated. Yeah? So this is the word for nibbana. So this, I think, this way of talking about things, although it's not really, this is taken from a treatise which is preserved in the Tibetan translation. It's an Indian treatise, but have in Tibetan translation, I think there's also a Sanskrit text of it. It's not really talked about much in the traditions. Even in the Tibetan tradition, they tended to not pay too much attention to this particular teaching of Vasubandhu. But I personally find this really helpful to again, to just to help to organise our thinking around these different kinds of issues. Yeah. About 4th century. Yeah, so Vasubandhu was more or less writing the immediate generation before Buddhaghosa in Sri Lanka and after Nagarjuna. So this, I think, when he formulated this, I think Vasubandhu was implicitly responding to Nagarjuna. Yeah. Yes, you see, that right there is the pain of unknowing. Yeah, I'm not really sure. It was certainly predated Nagarjuna. You don't find it in the canonical Abhidhamma texts. It's one of these things that's very much associated with the Abhidhamma tradition, but you don't actually find it in the Abhidhamma texts, like a lot of other ideas which are associated with the Abhidhamma tradition. I suspect you'll first find it in around the 1st century BC, before the emergence of the Prajnaparamita and the early Mahayana literature. And you'll probably find it talked about in some of the either late canonical or post-canonical Sarvasivadin Abhidharma texts, which you find in Chinese translation, something like the Jnanaprasthana, something like that. But I haven't really traced it, so that's just a kind of guess, because I know that the idea was current after that, so it must have, you know, when it appears in the Mahayana sutras and things, it's more or less taken for granted. So it must have emerged before that time. Yeah. No, that's a slightly different distinction. Mundane and supramundane is slightly different. Let me start again. Mundane and supramundane is a somewhat different kind of distinction. In that, mundane is referring to anything, essentially anything which is not nibbana, really, and not enlightenment. And supramundane is referring to enlightenment. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas ultimate reality, and this is again one of the problems where that's confused, ultimate reality, yeah, is not necessarily enlightenment from that traditional point of view. If I see seeing as seeing, yeah, then that's I'm seeing ultimate reality, ultimate truth. But I'm not seeing, obviously I'm not necessarily enlightened just because I saw sight as sight. That's right, yeah, it's the path of fruit, yeah. Mostly we find that. We don't find that distinction made as quite as explicitly. Some of the ways that it's applied are a bit problematic, but the basic idea, I think, is fine. Yeah. Yeah. One of the other contexts where this becomes, as I said, like a rhetorical device to exalt your own school is where you find in the Vipassana tradition, this is very strong. The Vipassana tradition will say Vipassana is about ultimate reality and Samatha is about conventional reality, and therefore you have to get onto ultimate reality before you can get enlightened. An idea which, incidentally, is, apart from anything else, contradictory to the Theravadan tradition on that. Interestingly enough, the Theravadan tradition, although it makes this distinction between ultimate and conventional reality, argues that enlightenment can happen through either way. Yeah? It does not say you have to know ultimate reality before you can get enlightened. And this is quite an interesting feature you find in the Theravadan commentaries. The reason for that is because of all the stories where people will do things like, you know, your stories where the nun washes her feet and watches the water fade into the ground and then she gets enlightened. Yeah? And you have many stories like this. And so in that respect, the commentaries preserve this idea that the purpose of wisdom is essentially pragmatic. Yeah? It doesn't matter how you know it. All that matters is that you get to that point of letting go. Right? This is really important. Another example of that is in the commentarial discussion of the eighth precept, where, and I'm not sure if I've mentioned this before, but I'm not sure of the eight precepts and talking about the precept of not listening to singing. Yeah? And music. Did I talk about this before? No, I can't remember. Maybe it was in the other. Of course I did. And the example it did for that, it says that, well, it's okay to listen to music if you don't have the intention. And it gives the example of a monk who's wandering for alms around and through the village. And then as he wanders for alms around, he overhears a slave woman singing a song about the sufferings of life. Which has to be the blues, right? Okay? I mean, what else could it possibly be, right? So, here's this slave woman singing the blues, and then he gets enlightened. Sees dukkha. Wow, bingo. So there you go. You can get enlightened by listening to John Lee Hooker. Yeah. All right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, that comes back to this distinction here. So in that case, seeing and ichidukkha anatta is the understanding by scrutiny, is tiranaparinya. So according to the commentarial system, in the Vipassana system, they rely on this system of Vipassana jnanas. The first of the Vipassana jnanas is the Nama-Rupa Pariccheda jnana, right, which is where you first start to distinguish between, you know, seeing in terms of conventions like self and me and mine and so on, and you start to see what they call Nama-Rupa. And that's more or less equivalent to this Jnata-Parinya. Yeah? So that's like the beginning of it. So, yeah, so the deeper level, but it's still regarded as being a Paramatta Satcha, yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah, it's what you do with it. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a very, very good story. I do not know. I don't know. I don't see why not. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting when you look at the you know, in the especially in the Theragata and Therigata, the voice, the verses of the monks and the nuns, you know, you see how these moments of enlightenment happen in such unpredictable ways. And to me, there is something that's very authentic about that, because it's not, in a sense, it's not kind of supporting an institutionalized practice. You know, there's something random about it, something personal, something individual. And to me, that idea to me sounds very authentic. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Okay, so here is Prajnaparamita, the mother of all the Buddhas, from Java. Another random image. Let's do some meditation. Okay, so moving on. So what we find in the suttas typically is a very pragmatic approach to developing wisdom and a very common sense one. And even though we find it mentioned in many different places, many different ways, we can discern some kind of patterns and tendencies in how that approach is supposed to be made. Now, this is not meant to be too systematic, but generally speaking, this is a kind of an outline of the main kinds of wisdom development that we find mentioned in many places in the suttas. This is not like one particular list from a particular place or anything like that. It's just a general grouping of terms relating to development of wisdom, which moves from the more basic towards the more profound. Beginning with Bahusutta, listening or learning. Yeah. So it's what you're doing here. Literally is much hearing. Okay, so one who's Bahusutta is learned. Of course, remembering that all listening in those days was from the oral tradition. And also remembering that the listening to teachings was also meant memorizing them. Yeah? So active listening. Not just passively sitting there and thinking that it'll all sink in somehow. Yeah? Reflecting, patisankhara. Yeah? So when you've heard those teachings, reflecting about them, thinking about them, investigating them, inquiring. How does that work? How does that fit in with that? What does that mean? And this, that level of patisankhara is also used in a general sense to, for example, reflect about one of the practices which is encouraged for the monastic sangha is to reflect about, say, the use of the requisites and use of the alms food. So when you eat, then you're supposed to reflect, okay, this food is offered for the sake of keeping me alive and keeping my practice going so that I can be healthy and strong for practicing Dhamma and not for the sake of just for the sake of enjoying the flavour. And so this is what patisankhara means. It's that way of reflecting about what you're doing. Yeah? Discussing, another very, very important aspect in the development of wisdom. Yeah? And we all know from modern education, we know that if you stick kids in a room and just lecture to them, they're not going to absorb anything. But you learn things from discussing about them. You have to learn to articulate them. Actually, my history teacher told the class once that if you can't articulate something, you don't really understand it. Yeah? That always really kind of struck me as being quite interesting, quite important. And this is why it's actually very good to have Dhamma discussion. That's why we have discussion as part of this course. That's why, it's a good thing to think about for yourselves. That I know it's not easy for a lot of people to have that chance to have Dhamma discussion, but it is something that's not too difficult to set up if you want to. Yeah, you can make a little Dhamma discussion group among your friends, set up a night, Tuesday nights we're going to get together and someone's going to bring a little reading or a little idea or a topic and we can discuss that. Or you can even do something at work, yeah, set up a little Dhamma group at work and find people who are interested, come together and discuss and so on. Throw ideas around and it'll help you. Another thing that I've been encouraging people, especially in Sydney, is to be getting involved in the teaching Dhamma at schools, especially primary schools. They have the volunteers for the scripture class. And I went along and did one of the scripture classes at a primary school a couple of weeks ago in Sydney. And it was about 100 kids or something like that. And it was a fantastic experience. And I was talking with the volunteer teachers there. So there's about four or five Buddhist teachers that go along there and so on. And they all said that, doing that process actually really helped them so much to understand the Dhamma better because all these kids keep asking them questions and they better know something about what they're talking about. So they actually found it was really, really useful to be able to help to understand the Dhamma better. So this is another thing that's a good thing to think about for yourselves too. Okay, so then there's aspect of applying things to your experience. So this is going a bit deeper. Yoniso Manasikara is one of the words that's used for this. So, for example, you hear the teaching on impermanence. Yeah, you then reflect about it, you talk about it, and so on. Then you go away and you meditate, and you say, "Okay, well, how does this work in my own experience?" Yeah. Then vipassana, we often call insight, or perhaps clear discernment might be a better rendering for vipassana. Again, vipassana being basically similar or the same as yonisomanasikara, really, in the way it's used in the suttas, but having that idea of a clear-eyed and undistorted vision of reality as it unfolds in our experience. Then there's the yathabhuta jnana dasana, knowing reality, as I've said here. Ananda mentioned this a little bit earlier, knowing things as they are. And this is something we have to be a little bit careful in our translations. So, yathabhuta jnana dasana doesn't actually really mean knowing things as they are. And this is a subtle but interesting problem in translation. What it actually means is, yatha means as or in line with, and bhuta, in Indian language, they tend to treat, there's a great subtlety and quite a philosophical importance to the way that the verbs to be are treated. And one of the reasons for that is because there's a strong tendency for the word be, when you say something is, to mean that something is eternal. Right? So to say something is doesn't just mean that it's there, it means that it exists in some fundamental and eternal sense. Yeah? And of course, this being one of the main ideas which the Buddha was interested in refuting or showing another side of. And so here he doesn't use the word are, he uses the word bhuta, which means literally become, and it's explained as being has been conditioned. Okay, so it means it has been, how things have been conditioned would probably be a better translation, rather than saying as things are, as things have been conditioned, or as things have come to be. Yeah? In other words, that knowledge and vision of reality is not a vision of a static state. Reality is like this, okay? That's not what it means. What it means is you understand the process of change and conditionality by which these things come to be and how they come to pass away. Yatha bhuta jnana dasana. Understanding conditionality, understanding dependent origination. When it's used in a technical sense in the early Buddhist texts, it usually means stream entry. Okay, so it's usually the first of the four paths of awakening. Or first of the four stages of awakening, stream entry. And it's usually said, the usual idiom in the suttas is that the stream enterer knows and sees in accordance with condition or how things have come to be, yatha bhuta jnana dasana, whereas the arahant, the fully enlightened one, knows the ending of suffering, the ending of all afflictions and defilements. So the stream enterer clearly sees the truth, knows exactly the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination and all of that stuff, but hasn't yet completely been able to let go. Okay, so that's something a bit like a smoker who knows all about the dangers of smoking and all of those things and knows how bad it is and really wants to let go, but just one more, never mind. Yeah. Okay, yatha bhuta jnana dasana. So then the knowing the ending of affliction, asavat kaya jnana, is the knowledge of arahantship, so the ending of all defilements. And interestingly enough, in the early Buddhist texts, they also talk about another kind of knowledge, which is the reviewing knowledge, which comes after enlightenment. You might think that enlightenment is all and then you've finished. No. And the other thing is the reviewing. And what the reviewing does is it reflects back on that experience and it puts that into some context. If you have an enlightenment experience, you know that you've had that experience, but you don't necessarily know what that experience is and what all the implications of it are, right? So reflective knowledge is to reflect back and to see, well, what actually happened? What's, you know, are certain, do I still have these defilements? Are they still in me or not? Is this a temporary state? I mean, often people have profound experiences in meditation and so on, which feel like enlightenment, but then it turns out afterwards that it's only temporary and the mind reverts back. So you reflect back and say, is this going to revert? What happens? What's the actual nature of that? So this is that process of reviewing or patuvekana. And that happens not just at that moment of enlightenment, but Pachacutela is used actually all through the Buddha's text for that idea of reviewing. And a very important part of it, and you know from your workplace, if you do a project or job or something like that, reviewing is an intrinsic part of doing that process, right? And that if you don't review what you've done, you will never do it better, learn how to do it better next time. Yeah. So this is also an intrinsic part of the Buddhist way of developing knowledge, that whatever's happened, you can review it, reflect about it, what just happened, how can you learn from that? Mm-hmm. Sure. Of course, yeah. No, you have to review. You have to understand what's happened to you. Pasada, you're going to ask a question. Sure. Yeah, why not? Oh. You don't know about it. Well, what if you're a stream enter and you die and you get reborn as a human again? When you're a little baby, are you going to know that you're a stream enterer? No? So the essence of these stages of enlightenment is that something is absent. No? That's the essence of them, that those defilements, which previously were leading to suffering, are not there anymore. Okay, and absence is not something which is automatic or which you're going to notice. Right? And it actually says this quite explicitly in the suttas. This question is asked, does an arahant always know that they're an arahant? And then the question is, no, they only know it when they review it. And the example is given is if a man has lost a limb, are they constantly always conscious of having lost a limb? Well, not only when they review that fact, when they pay attention to it. Yeah? So that those defilements are always gone, right? So those things which lead to suffering are always there, and that can't lead rise to suffering. But you're not necessarily always aware of that fact. Yeah. So it's an interesting thing to think about, that question of you know, they're actually not talked about in the suttas at all. The suttas say that a stream enterer can be reborn up to 7 times, but they don't really say what happens if a stream enterer is reborn as a human or something like that, what it really is like for that. There's kind of anecdotal accounts in modern times that what happens is that you basically you don't really know what's up, but as you grow older, you become aware that there's something different about you, that other people do things that you can't understand why they do it, right? Because you don't have those same tendencies in yourself that would lead to those doing those same things. And then at a certain point, then there's a realization or an understanding through reflection of what the situation is. But that's anecdotally the kind of thing that I've heard. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not sure what you're asking. I mean, the Magapala idea is really a commentarial idea. I'm not sure what you're asking about. Are you asking about at the time of when someone realizes something, or are you talking about that context I mentioned of someone getting reborn? You know that there's been an experience, but you don't necessarily know what that experience is and what that means until you've reflected about it. Yeah? And this is, I mean, this is, that's you know, you do find that in the suttas. You also find that in the Visuddhimagga, it talks about that. Even in that model of the vipassana jnanas and so on, after the Magapala, immediately following is the Pachacutela jnana, which is the reviewing. Yeah. again, you know that something's happened, but you don't necessarily know all the implications and the meaning of that. And that's a process of reviewing to understand that. Yeah, so that's all that it means. Yeah, again, those defilements are absent. Yeah, but which defilements are absent and what does it mean? What's the implication and so on? This is something that arises through reflection. Yeah. You even see in the suttas, for example, that people will ask questions about this. Like Ananda asks a question, like, how does a stream enterer know that they're a stream enterer? Yes, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Yeah. So, and the Buddha gives this reflective method so that somebody can do that. Another question is asked, Sariputta asks about whether a stream enterer can go to hell. Right? And the Buddha says, actually, you know, a stream enterer can't go to hell. But even Sariputta didn't know that until the Buddha taught about it. And he said, actually, I didn't want to teach about this because I didn't want all the stream enterers to get lazy. Right? Yeah? So actually, even though they're stream enterers, they don't know everything about that status of stream entry. And so you learn about it through reflection. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, you could hardly not. Yeah, you're like, whoa. You're like, whoa, that's so awesome. Okay. So, Mike, did you have your hand up before? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Another description I've heard of it is that something disappears that you didn't know was there in the first place. And it's not until it's gone that you realise that it was there. Yeah. Eddie, we haven't heard from you this morning. What's wrong? That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't gone into detail into those particular things, but if you look at that one that they translate as rites and rituals, actually the Pali is sila bhata, sila meaning ethics or precepts, and bhata meaning vows, okay, literal translation, precepts and vows. But interestingly enough, if you look at that word sila, actually, as well as meaning the word sila as in precepts, if you change the emphasis, it means rock. Okay, so sila is a rock. Yeah? And vata, yeah, if you know from samsara, like the samsara vata is the rolling on of samsara. So sila vata is actually rock and roll. So what that means is attachment to rock and roll is the problem. Yeah. I think so, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So in the suttas, actually, you have an extraordinarily rich vocabulary to dealing with wisdom. Oops, that's a mistake. Oh, anyway. Extraordinarily rich vocabulary dealing with wisdom. Lots of different terminology. I'm just mentioning here, just throwing out a few terms that you'll find mentioned around the place. Banya is the most common word, usually translated as wisdom or understanding. Jnana, knowledge, again, usually translated as knowledge. The difference between the two is that jnana can be plural, right? You can have different knowledges, yeah? But panya is singular. You can only have one wisdom. Parinya, very similar. Anya, again, meaning finding knowledge. Parinya and anya are usually reserved for arahantship. Jnana is used more generally. Panya is also used more generally. These four words and quite a few others are all derived from the same root, nya, which is actually cognate with the English word know. dasana vision and often combined. It's very characteristic of the Buddhist idioms, and I think the Indo-European idioms generally, but especially the Buddhist idiom, to combine these words of knowledge and vision. We find this constantly in many, many ways. Medha, wisdom, more of a poetic word. And lastly, I've got here is vidya, true knowledge or realization. And vidya is usually used for the te vidya, the three higher knowledges. That's realized often at arahantship, recollection of past lives, the knowledge of the dying and reappearing of beings according to their karma, and knowledge of the ending of defilements, the asavakaya jnana, as being the third of the three vidya. And interesting from an etymological point of view, that I mentioned that jnana is related to the English know. Okay, so it's interesting when you see the roots of these words, you can sometimes understand why they have peculiar spellings, right? So why is the English word know spelt in that odd way? Well, it's actually a remnant of the J. It says nya at the beginning, but in Sanskrit it's jnana, and there's a J there. And so that kind of ends, and that's why the K is still there in the English know. And vidya is also cognate with a lot of English words, wit. Right, witness, wisdom. I'm not sure whether wisdom is actually cognate or not. I should look that up. But the other one, which is I think very interesting, is wicca. Not as in wicca basket, but as in wicca, as in what witches do. Witch also being a word from the same root, witch being essentially meaning a person of knowledge, right? a knowledge bearer. And wicca, as in W-I-C-C-A, the religion of the witches, essentially meaning a secret or esoteric knowledge. Yeah? And vidya in Pali has exactly the same meaning. Yeah? And you can see how the spelling is exactly parallel. The W becomes V and the J's become C, and vidya becomes wicca. Wizard, I'm pretty sure, also does, yeah. So if wizard does, wizard must be related to wise. Yeah, so I'd have to check that. Wizard and wise, it probably does come from vidya, yeah. Video also does. Gnosis in Greek is from the same jnana root, yeah, jnana, knowledge, yeah. So it's interesting, one of the things that shows you, when you have such a prevalence of the Indo-European roots in English and modern European languages, one of the things that shows you is how important these words for that culture, right? So just to give a parallel, the words for cow is go in Indian. So this is an Indo-European root we still have in English. And the word for horse is asa, which also is cognate with the English horse, right? So cows and horses were very important for the ancient Indo-Europeans, right? Sheep is not, goat is not, and so on. So we can tell something about that culture by seeing what were the important words. And very, very noticeable how prevalent all of these words for knowledge and knowing and wisdom and understanding and so on are in English, and most of them all have very prominent Indo-European roots and very recognizable. So this is something which I think that emphasis on reflection and understanding and wisdom is maybe something which we picked up from that Indo-European culture. Right. Wisdom, right. Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, oh, there you go. Yeah, okay, very good. Oh, that's interesting. So they're more Indo-European roots, but it seems Sophia is not, I don't think. Not sure where that comes from. Yeah. But it's not Indo-European, I don't think, anyway. Yeah. Okay, I think so. Okay. So, I'm just seeing. Okay. How much we've got more? Okay, so how does wisdom work? So we've looked at different aspects of wisdom so far this morning. I'm just going to try to draw that together a little bit in these next couple of slides. How does wisdom work? First point is that wisdom is not a special faculty, but it's the developed form of ordinary understanding. Okay? This, I think, is extremely important to bear in mind. You all have wisdom, right? A little wisdom is knowledge or understanding. It's not like a different kind of thing. It's the same thing that everybody has and that you all use every day. Yeah? Yeah? Every kind of knowledge that we have, every kind of understanding that we have, is all a little bit of wisdom. And so by deepening and extending and broadening that same thing, we're deepening our wisdom. So there's nothing esoteric, nothing special about it. Okay? I think this is one thing that's very important to bear in mind. Second point, all, and I'm making quite a bold claim here, all understanding is an unpredictable knowing that arises mysteriously. In other words, all understanding is intuition. Now that might seem a bit counterintuitive, but what am I trying to get at here? Okay? I think this is a very fascinating thing about the nature of wisdom or the nature of knowing. Let me ask you a question. What's 2 plus 2? And what happens in your mind when I ask that question? Yeah? You calculate? Do you? Really? Really? But these are all kind of ideas. These are all conceptualizings about it. What actually happens in your mind when I say that? If I say what's 2 plus 2, what actually happens? That's right. Exactly. The number 4 appears. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. I'm taking it for granted that everybody here knows how to add 2 plus 2. Yeah. So that appears. Where does it come from? And then when you say that, people say, oh, it comes from memory, or it comes from this, or it comes from that. But again, these are just kind of ideas. In your experience, it's not there, and then it is. Right? And even if it's something that we have to think about more, we have to reflect about. Let's say if I say, what's 257 minus 3? Okay, I have to think about it for a minute. Still, even if it's something you have to use a rational process to get to the answer, at the end of the day, the answer's not there, and then it is. Right? Where does it come from? But also notice the other thing that's associated with that. When the answer comes, there's a relief of tension. Right? And you all know this from something like, say, doing the crosswords or anything like that, right? Oh, what is that? What is that? What is that? And the words on the tip of your tongue. Oh, I don't know. And there's a tension in your mind. There's a driving force, right? So this comes back to that emotional thing that was pointed to earlier. Yeah, there's actually an emotion which is felt as a tension. It's felt as a splitting or a difference, right? I want something. There's a wanting which is different from the reality. I want to know this, but I don't know it. Yeah? It's pulling apart. And then it's like a rubber band is being stretched. What is it? And then, I know. And when you know, first of all, that knowledge isn't there. Then it appears. Now, of course, there's all kinds of conditioning which go into that, right? All of your thinking and your education and your experience and your knowledge and memory, all of that lies behind that. But your experience is that it's not there and then it is. And it always comes with a sense of ease, yeah? A sense of peace, a sense of gladness. Okay. Yeah? And I think this is a really important thing to understand about knowledge. Come back to the idea I mentioned, raised right at the beginning. There's something about knowledge which is inherently pleasing. It's inherently what we want to do. We want to know. Our minds are built to be knowing machines, if you like. That's our purpose of our minds. We want to be conscious. And the more that we're conscious, the more we know and the more we understand, the more we experience that sense of ease and confidence about things. We always know how, you know, even if you think of simple social situations, right? The other day I went to a conference and sort of you walk into the room and you kind of notice, well, there's this kind of sense of unease, right? Because I don't know anybody, right? There's all these strangers there. Oh, there's my friend, yeah? I go over and I say hello and you feel so much better. Because there's a knowing there. You don't feel lost. So knowing always comes with that positive emotional sense, a sense of accomplishment, achievement, peace. So the information is processed largely unconsciously. Maybe some of it's conscious, but a lot of it's unconscious, and it arrives more or less whole. And so this is why, if we come back to that these different words and ideas around wisdom, you can see that for the development of wisdom, some of those things are things we can do consciously, like learning and studying, reflecting and talking, and other things come through meditation, through being still. And it's through being still that all of that knowledge and information is synthesized and comes to make sense in a far deeper form. Right? So this is why in the Buddhist tradition, if we want to increase our wisdom, there are two essential things that we can do. One is that we focus on those things that we can do, the learning, the study, the reflection, and so on and so forth. And doing that, we get more information that we can turn into wisdom. But the other thing that we can do to deepen our wisdom is to make our minds still, to empty our minds of all of those things, empty our minds of learning and thinking and reflecting and all of those things, and have a stillness. And when that stillness is there, the wisdom will be synthesized and come together in deeper and deeper ways. Yes, Dania. Mysteriously. Well, there is something about knowing which has that faculty, doesn't it? Like if you, let's say if you are, if you're a kid and you're it's Christmas Day and Mum and Dad are bringing, Santa Claus is bringing presents and stuff, and then one day you discover actually it's really just Dad dressed up in a suit. Yeah? And you can't unknow that, right? You're not necessarily thinking about it all the time, right? But you know from that moment, Santa Claus isn't real. Sorry to break the news if anyone's. And so all of those, and it's not just that intellectual knowledge about that, but that whole emotional relationship, right, is completely changed because of that, and it can't go back. Yeah. That's right, yeah. So that's like the kids, they still want to enjoy Christmas even though they know Santa's not real. They still get something out of it. Well, again, you always understand these things by reference to just ordinary consciousness, yeah, ordinary awareness. Yeah? And in ordinary awareness, let's say you're a smoker and you've been smoking all your life perfectly happily, and then somebody goes and ruins the fun by showing you a picture of someone with lung cancer, right? And, well, from then on you know that this is something that's going to be harmful for me. But you don't necessarily give up right then, yeah? And it maybe takes some time and some reflection and so on, but the seeds are planted, yeah? And you can't really view that act of smoking a cigarette in the same way. Yeah? Wayne. Right. Oh, definitely, yeah. For at the time of like realization of the Dhamma or something like that, yeah, there's a very root level transformation. Yeah. Sorry? Yep. Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what you're asking though. Yeah, I'm still not. I mean, okay. I think. Yeah, I'm not sure I entirely get your point. But anyway, yes, you're quite right. You know, it takes a. It's not just seeing these things or whatever, but there's a depth to it, and how that plays out is then very different. We've been talking about these general principles, but how they actually play out in any individual will vary a lot. I'm just seeing what's the time. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it actually talks about that in the suttas, like one of the conditions for the arising of right view, parato gohosa and yonaso manasikara. Yeah, parato gohosa, the words of another, and yonaso manasikara is the, as I mentioned before, is like basically applying that to your own experience. Yeah. So we'll come back to you, Eddie. We'll just have a few other people here. So this is my little summary of how wisdom works here. Wisdom's informed by knowledge. Okay, so that's what we're doing here. We're getting some knowledge, questioning, discussion, and so on. It's integrated in stillness. Yeah? So it's through stillness, especially through meditation, samadhi, that all of those little bits of knowledge and information will gradually settle down and they'll all kind of fit in together. They'll come into their own place. Yeah? It's accompanied by confidence. And this is what I was talking before, that emotional connotation with wisdom. Interesting, isn't it? When you know, there's an emotional sense of confidence about knowing something. Yeah? You even think about that. You know, think about the basic sort of classroom situation. Your teacher asks the question, who knows the answer? Oh, somebody knows. I know the answer. I know. And when there's a knowing, there's a confidence that comes into your mind with that. Yeah? And that is the confidence at the deepest level, which is the avecca passada, the confirmed confidence of a stream enterer. Yeah? So that you can see that when the Buddha's talking about these things, the way that, say, samadhi leads to knowledge, right? It's not just a purely Buddhist thing that happens in a meditation context. That's actually how the mind works. Stillness is what leads to the arising of wisdom, wherever you have, right? Same thing, that when the wisdom comes, it comes with confidence. And when the Buddha's talking about the confidence of the stream enter, again, it's not a random thing. That's what happens when knowledge arises. Yeah, you have that confidence. And that leads to peace. Yeah, when you have that knowing, there's a settled feeling about that. So this is something I've been trying to emphasize from the beginning, that when we talk about the development of wisdom in Buddhism, we're not talking about something which is special or unique or different. We're talking about the continued and further development of the same ordinary understanding, ordinary wisdom, ordinary knowledge that you have all the time and that you use every day in everything that you do. Yeah? That's what wisdom is. And those same advantages that you see that knowledge has or understanding has at work or in the home or at the school or wherever it is, and the same benefits and so on are the same things that you'll find in Buddhism at the deep levels of understanding. But of course, because the wisdom is deeper, the letting go is deeper, the stillness is deeper, then the benefits are greater. But still the same kind of thing as we talk in our everyday context. Okay, so that's enough for this morning. Thank you all for your attention. I have to break and go for the dana now. And we will see you all back here at 12:30.